Hi, everybody. This is another podcast episode. Thank you for tuning in. Today, I have a pretty interesting guest, Jeff Grigg, who works, he will introduce himself, but he works for as a developer for a multinational company. So he travels a lot and he codes a lot and, you know, does all the other things that come with those two things. And we're going to discuss, we're going to start with the subject of code ownership. That's a conversation that kind of originated on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. And I found it very interesting because I never really heard that as a concept or an issue. So as we quickly discussed it with Jeff, it caught my attention. So I invited Jeff over so we could talk about that. And then he also has other interesting things to cover, like extreme programming and things like that. So without further ado, I'll let Jeff introduce himself. Jeff, thank you for coming. Go ahead.
And thank you for inviting me. I am Jeff Grigg, and as mentioned, I have a fairly large number of years of experience in software development, way back to when personal computers were a brand new thing. So I've experienced traditional approaches and also the new agile approaches. And that's one of the code ownership is something that changed between the old and new approaches and is done less now than before. So to talk about code ownership, I was thinking that we could think about, say, I and a couple other developers get together and decide we want to write some programs, say, to run some small businesses. Now, how would we organize ourselves? Well, probably each of us talks about the requirements, talks to the business person, and finds part of the system that interests us, and we start doing that. So let's say we're automating something for dentists, and I find doing insurance claims really interesting. So I write most of this as part of the system that does insurance claims. Well, then I'm the expert on that. I know the most about that code. I spent a lot of time writing and debugging it. So when somebody wants some changes to that part, who's the most sensible person for them to ask? Well, that would be me, because I know the most about it.
Makes sense.
Also, if somebody else were to go in and change the code, well, they're going to have to test not just the changes that they made, but everything that could possibly be affected by the changes that they made. And they're probably not really familiar with all this code I wrote. So it's going to take them a long time to figure out how to test it effectively. That's very costly and time consuming. So it's just generally, you know, just without any kind of methodology or tools or any fancy stuff, it's usually most efficient for whoever wrote the code to continue maintaining it. And we usually call that code ownership. I wrote this code and informally, I own it. I should make all the changes to it. So does that kind of make sense?
It makes perfect sense, yes.
Yes, but you also have to look at it from a business perspective. Now we've just taken the program, the system, and divided it into 6 or 12 different parts, and one expert knows about each part. But suppose we want to make a bunch of changes to one part. Well, only one person really knows that very well. What are the other people on the team going to do? So it's really hard to schedule and get a lot of stuff done and be really effective if with code ownership and with the costs of moving code from one person to another so that they have to become familiar with it and figure out how to write tests for it and all of that. Well, that's been a problem for many years. And when people came up with the idea of extreme programming, they found ways of reducing those costs and making it a lot easier to test so that code ownership was no longer necessary. The biggest part of that is test-driven development, where that's where testing frameworks like JUnit come from. where developers write tests while writing the code and let the test drive writing the code. So you end up with really good automated tests that cover all the functionality that you've written. Well, that's really great for transferring ownership to another person because all the tests are already automated. To test it again, you just run the tests again. And if you want to know what the software is supposed to do, you read the tests and the tests tell you what it's supposed to do. So that makes it a lot easier to achieve something that we call collective code ownership, which is anyone on the team can make changes to the code. And of course, first they have to change the tests and do test-driven development and refactoring to maintain high quality and high testing. But it's a lot easier to do that with all these tests from test-driven development. So that moves us away from most of those business problems that we had with strict code ownership into this new area of collective code ownership, where you can assign a task to almost anyone and they'll be able to pick it up and work quickly and effectively on it. So does that seem to make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I have a question. So
sure.
would you say that test-driven development is pretty much the perfect solution, or there are also issues with this approach?
Well, test-driven development is still kind of controversial within software development. It is a major part of extreme programming, but not strictly mandated by most other agile methods. Extreme programming came up with this idea and requires it.
Okay.
Now, extreme programming also uses other techniques. An even more controversial technique is pair programming, where two programmers sit down at a single computer and work together to write the software. Now, you might think that that would slow things down a lot, but there's a lot more thinking than typing in computer programming. Mm-hmm. So the improved thinking actually makes them more productive. And having a pair partner is really good for maintaining discipline, and you really need high discipline to do test-driven development effectively. So your partner helps you do test-driven development, helps keep the code coverage at 100%, keep the quality really high, and also, because the two of you are working together, now both of you know all about that code. And often we switch pairs, so pretty soon everyone on the team is familiar with all the code in the system because they've all worked on it. So that really helps with things like collective code ownership because they all know it and can work on it.
Mm-hmm. I can actually totally relate to the pair programming concept. I did the same thing, but not in coding, but in financial modeling when I worked as a consultant, and we built a lot of all kinds of models in Excel. And some of them were so complex that we would have two people sitting in front of the computer. And again, you know, there's a lot more thinking than actual typing in Excel when you build all kinds of models. And yeah, the results were a lot more superior this way, because you know the other pair of eyes always sees something that you don't, and the other way around. And then kind of, you know, real time conversation, real time feedback from each other to each other, it just speeds up those, you know, thinking dynamics. You know, the velocity is just amazing. So I can relate to that. And so based on the fact that I can relate to that, and I actually find it beneficial as well, why do you say that it is called a controversial practice?
Well, our experience has been that pairing works in quite a few areas, not just computer programming, but wherever creativity and engineering, creative thinking kind of things dominate the work, pairing works really well. Now, it does not work extremely well for tedious routine work that that a single person can do well because the other person will just get really bored. But that the real reason why it's really controversial is that it's really hard for most people to understand how two people doing one job could be more effective than the two of them just working independently. Wouldn't they get twice the work done? But it really doesn't work that way in practice. When done well, pair programming is even more productive than the two people working independently. Go ahead.
So this reminded me of a tweet by somebody with a pretty, you know, big authority on Twitter in terms of product development or, you know, development. I can't remember who that was. I saw this tweet a few weeks ago. Somebody said, whatever takes one developer 1 month will take two developers 2 months. And a lot of people actually agreed with this tweet. So, but what you're saying is, you know, if implemented correctly, it can actually be very beneficial and it will actually reduce the time of the development.
Yes. And there are some ideas about how well you can put more people on a project. Like there's a book called Mythical Man Month that is really classic, and it talks about project management in software development. And it explains that, well, one thing it says is adding people to a late project makes it later. Mm-hmm. And that's often the case because when you add people to a project, they have to get up to speed. They have it will be a while before they're really effective. And so they slow down the other people while they're getting up to speed. Also, there's the issue of what they call partitionability, which is the age-old question of it takes one woman 9 months to produce a baby, so you assign nine women to the task.
I think I've heard something like that, yeah.
Yeah, that's a terrible thing to say, but there are some things that just one person has to work on it to completion, and it's just going to take that long. And in reality, there are a lot of tasks that you can divide between people, but putting two times as many people won't make it quite twice as fast, and putting 10 times as many people definitely will not make it 10 times as fast. Maybe 10 people will be twice as fast. Mm-hmm. There's a real law of diminishing returns in terms of multiplying the number of people. And as managers, we have to realize that.
Gotcha. And so this pair programming, is it business as usual type of practice, or it's only for certain stages of the product development?
Well, it's something that is mandated by extreme programming, which is pretty strict about the practices that you should follow. And extreme programming has these strict rules that you must not write a line of production code without first writing a test and working with a pair partner. So absolutely all software development work would be done with pair programming and test-driven development. Now, if we're talking about build scripts and deploying to a box, that is kind of different kind of work. So things may vary a bit in teams.
Okay. And what's your experience with extreme programming? Have you spent most of your life in this environment or not? And what advantages do you see on both sides of the equation?
Well, I've been in and out of the extreme programming environments, and I've been involved discussing extreme programming and agile techniques in the community for the whole time that we've been talking about this publicly, which is a little over 20 years.
Okay.
Now, extreme programming can be a really great thing, but it's almost like a religion. The whole team and management has to buy into it and dive in and really do it to make it effective. And when you do that, it can be extremely effective. It can multiply productivity by several times. But it's not the easiest thing to get going, and it's not the easiest thing to convince people that that's the right way to do the work.
Why is it not the easiest thing to get it going? Because I mean, I've been working exactly in the same area of change management and implementing new processes in the organizations. I never, for example, implemented Agile in an organization. I tried to kind of put some steps towards moving people to Agile and sprints and stuff like that, but never did I transform a major organization from a waterfall, for example, to Agile. So I can totally relate to the fact that companies, especially the bigger the company, the harder that would be, how hard it is to make a change like that. So why do you think extreme programming would be, what are the top two reasons that you think might be the challenges for that implementation?
Well, certainly, in all organizations, change is hard. And in much of the industry, we've seen a large movement towards agile methods. We hear a lot about Scrum and SAFe and various other agile approaches. So a lot of people are doing fixed length iterations and having daily stand-up meetings and various things that are really very much like Scrum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. All of that is really good. Oh, and also continuous integration. We have these great Jenkins build servers that build the software and run tests. And
right,
a lot of people are running tests. It's really great to write JUnit tests. Mm-hmm. Which automatically test the software. Now, going for the complete discipline of extreme programming is a really large mindset change, and it's kind of hard to find people who will train you on that, and it's kind of hard to convince, the leadership of a large company that this is the right way to do things, and so we should dramatically change the way that work is done to do it this way.
How far up the ladder do you need to go to ask for the implementation of this change? Does it end at the PMO organization level or product manager level, or you have to go all the way up to chief technology officer?
Well, I think experience has shown it can go either way. The original extreme programming project was one project manager said, things have not been working out, let's try this. And so on one project manager just did it. And I've done that myself on a couple other projects where I walk in and I talk to just a few developers and we all agree, let's just do it. And we're the only project doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It can also work the other way. I know of a couple of companies that write a lot of software, and at the high level, they've said, we're just going to write all software using extreme programming. We're going all the way. All of our teams will do extreme programming. We're doing it. And they have been quite successful at doing that. So it could go either way, top to bottom or bottom to top.
Mm-hmm. So when you guys decided to do that on your project, did you need anybody's approval at all, or you just kind of made a decision among yourselves and nobody had to kind of give you a green light?
It depends an awful lot on what kind of corporate culture you're in. Many people don't seem to realize that the individual teams usually have a lot of freedom and leeway in terms of how they're going to do the actual work. Most people above just want you to get it done and deliver the software, and they don't really care how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So if the people on your project, if your peers that you're working with agree with you and you all agree that you want to do this, you can do a lot of things without having to go up to the chief technology officer or any of the official people for the unofficial methodology or approval. You just start doing it and nobody stops you.
Gotcha. And just a silly question from the process and that type of stuff standpoint. In the extreme programming, do you guys also have sprints and user stories and product backlogs and things like that? Or what exactly changes in terms of and like you mentioned those stand-up meetings and things of that nature. What exactly changes in terms of the daily process routines?
Yes, well, most of just about everything you mentioned there is pretty much standard for agile methods, including extreme programming. And much of that was not standard in the older methodologies, which emphasized writing documentation a lot more and planning the whole project up front and in great detail. Now, in terms of differences, for places that really take on full extreme programming, a really shocking thing is you walk into the team room and there are half as many computers as programmers. Which
Okay.
is, yeah, that's just flat out
Did
shocking.
they all forget laptops at home?
No. I just mentioned pair programming.
Oh, pair programming. Gotcha,
All work
gotcha.
is done as pairs. So
So
you
it
need.
means they don't even get their own computer for, whatever else they had to do outside of coding, like, checking emails and stuff. They just use the same computer for administrative tasks too.
Well, actually, usually people have laptops or other smaller computers to handle email and such things. But the team centers around a number of big, powerful desktop computers,
Gotcha.
one for every two developers.
Got it. What type of so obviously you're a big believer in extreme programming and it seems like it has worked well for you. Would you say that every single software development project is suitable for this practice, or you would categorize only certain types of either size-wise or organization-wise or specific software-wise, like SaaS or something like that, or would you just blanket everything with this?
Yes, well, when we initially started this, we were really hesitant and weren't sure whether it would really scale to larger projects or work for things beyond business systems. But in the last 20 years, as we've been trying it and working on different systems, we have not found any place where it does not work. Now, of course, it is tricky to scale any methodology to really large projects. If you're developing millions of lines of code and you need 100 people working on it, then that doesn't work as one team. So Scrum talks a lot about you have teams and like a dozen teams, each with some people on them, and then you have a Scrum of Scrums that coordinates those teams to work with each other. Also, for other kinds of software, people are concerned in highly regulated environments, and for safety critical software, you have lots of rules, but realize that in extreme programming, you never write a line of code without writing an automated test first. Absolutely all the code is tested again and again. For every change you make, you retest all the software. It's a technique that fundamentally heavily relies on automated testing. So it is actually pretty good for things that have to be very reliable because of that strong emphasis on testing.
How many lines of code on average go into one of those tests during extreme programming? Because you write so many tests for the code. What's the average number of lines of code that is suitable for a
Well,
test?
you want each test to be simple, easy, understandable, and readable. So ideally, tests would only be half a dozen lines or so. Now, a metric that we usually talk more about is that you'll write at least as many lines of test code as production code, maybe 2 to 3 times as much. It depends on how efficient your libraries are and such. So 1 to 3 times as much code as your production code will be test code. And you want it to be simple and readable.
And in the pair programming, both developers write both codes, or one would write the production code and one would kind of help with the test code, or every single line of code is thought about and produced by both people?
Yes, well, there are a couple of different styles that people work in. Sometimes one person writes code and test while the other person thinks at a higher level and makes suggestions. But a technique that I like to use is one person writes a test and then hands the keyboard to the other person and says, you make this test work. I wrote a new test. It fails because the system doesn't have this functionality. You write the minimum amount of code to make it work. And so they do. And then they write the second test and hand it back to me and say, I just put in a new test and it fails. You write the code. So we go back and forth and back and forth, which is really kind of interesting and fun to do.
It does sound interesting because you learn by going through errors, through mistakes, right? You learn, like, if you wrote something that doesn't work, you at some point understand why it didn't work. So it's a learning. And then as two of you are exposed to all of this code and all of these tests, it makes perfect sense in terms of efficiency and improvement opportunity for the developers.
Yes, and some interesting things happen. Like, developers like me like to talk a lot, and sometimes one of us will say, well, I know what we should do with this program. We should put in one of these, and we should change this, and we should do that. And my partner will say, can you write a test for that? And hand me the keyboard. So then I have to stop talking, and I have to write a test that will move us in the direction of doing that. And that kind of means that I can't write that code. I have to hand the keyboard back to them, and they'll write some code. And so it refocuses our attention on accomplishing concrete goals rather than talking abstractly. And that can be really help your productivity.
Makes sense. So in your current company, how long have you worked in this very organization?
Well, my current employer, I've been there for 9 years.
Okay.
And we do agile. My current company is not really committed to extreme programming. I know some other companies that are heavily committed to it. We do agile.
Can you share any examples of companies that are committed?
Yes. Well, I worked with a very nice company in St. Louis called Asynchrony. And they do all projects full on exactly extreme programming.
Okay. Were you there when they switched? Were you there during that painful change management process? Or you came when they already did that?
No, well, they had already committed to that, and they don't hire people without talking about it first and getting the new employees to commit to doing this, because it's kind of a radical change for most programmers to go from whatever they've been doing to the discipline of extreme programming. And, you know, I mentioned it can be kind of a shock when you walk into a team room and there are half as many computers as people. You have no choice. You're going to pair program or you're not going to work. And it works really well. In fact, this company does a lot of projects that have what we call a story point based bidding or pricing system, where in each iteration, we estimate the stories in terms of points. and each point has a certain dollar amount, and that's what we're going to charge the customer. So each iteration...
The customer, the sponsor of the project?
Yes, it's a contracting company and does work for the government and insurance mm-hmm. companies and various other businesses. So okay. the contracts are structured that say 2-week iterations. Every iteration, the customer picks the stories they want us to implement. And it's fixed price based on our estimates. We finish the stories. They pass all the tests. We get that amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's a different way of approaching the business. And it can work really well for both the customer and the contracting company. Also, it gives the customer a lot of flexibility because at any time they can say, well, I like the software the way it is, and I don't want to buy a lot more changes. So they mm-hmm. can control their costs a lot more easily that way.
Makes sense. And to kind of quickly go back to when you mentioned that the company was hiring based on extreme programming commitment, that makes perfect sense. That's the perfect way to start building up that culture and expertise. Because, you know, some people will never change. Some people will change very slowly and painfully. A very small amount of people will say, oh, yeah, absolutely, let's do it this way. But the best way is to, because, you know, especially with the company that is growing, you're always hiring more and more people. So once you kind of say, no more developers who will not commit to extreme programming, and that will that should do it for the most part. That's a really solid approach.
Yes. In our industry, people are often really accustomed to going off into a corner and writing code for hours or days at a time without talking to anyone. So this requirement for pair programming means that you're going to be socializing, sitting next to a person, working with them and talking with them all day long, every single day. That's that big change. And not everyone is ready to make that change.
This is an excellent point. That's something that I didn't even think about, but it makes perfect sense. And I was gonna, you know, jump in and say right away, yeah, I mean, that's a great thing. But at the same time, as you continue to talk, you know, developers do tend to be more, you know, just leave me alone and let me do my thing. Yeah, I mean, pushing people towards socialization, I mean, it's a limited socialization. It's not like you are putting them on a stage and in front of, you know, 1,000 people. But sitting next to somebody and sharing knowledge real time and then kind of small chit-chat, you know, about family, traveling, you know, whatnot during breaks or just, you know, inside the conversation.
At the water cooler.
yeah, I mean, it actually makes sense. I wonder, so as I said, I could relate to that, but it was not a business as usual. It was more of a need-based pair Excel financial modeling where financial models were so complex that two people needed to sit down, you know, maybe once a week to understand what's working or what is not working and why it's not working and how to fix it. So that obviously sped up the thinking process. I wonder if such practices will also work for, you know, UX designers or something like that. Because, you know, obviously there's a lot of thinking in this area. Because, you know, it takes me 1 minute to sketch a screen in PowerPoint. But, you know, it takes me 10 minutes to kind of visualize what I actually want to accomplish on the screen and what objects I want on the screen and stuff like that. So I wonder if some kind of a demand-based, not business as usual as pair programming, extreme programming culture could be applicable to potentially more efficient things like UX design, for example.
Yes, it's certainly been our experience that any kind of work that involves a fair amount of thinking and a fair amount of creativity does benefit from pairing in some way.
I wonder, though, if companies, especially finance people, would look at it as doubling the cost of stuff for, you know, how I can imagine how hard it is to go and prove to a finance person who is only interested in reducing the costs in the organization to prove to them that, you know, two people is actually better than one, but the output is not going to be 2x, but maybe like 1.5x, right? And then they will tell you, well, then give me half a person, not another entire one, right? So that's another struggle in corporations, I would assume.
Yes, and that's where a large portion of the resistance comes in, because it's easy to look and say, well, you got two people doing one job, get rid of one, and then it'll cost half as much. But like I said, with creative problem solving that involves a fair amount of thinking, two people working together get the stuff done more than twice as fast. Now, they will get bogged down when the thinking turns into the tedious details of debugging and all, you know, cascading style sheets and details of HTML. Mm-hmm. When it gets tedious, then pairing really does not give you a benefit. So for most people, you have to know when it will benefit, when you should do it, and when you should work alone, and which one is better for each kind of work.
So what you're saying is that pair programming does not imply full-time two people at one computer. At some point, they split into two and do some other things?
Well, extreme programming does it always as pairs. But what I'm saying is, well, and optimizes the work so that works well. But what I'm saying is, generally speaking, if you're not going to be that extreme, you need to know what work works well with pairing and what work is better, just tedious routine paperwork that you got to get done, and just one person is the most effective way to do it.
Okay, so it's basically project specific chunk based, right? So you would say, you know, you guys code this as a pair program and you guys code this as a single programmer, right?
Yeah, well, say that doing the build and deploying to a machine and then doing all the steps is something that takes an hour to do and interrupts you every 5 minutes because you have to do another manual step. Well, that's going to be really tedious and boring for an hour long, and having somebody sit next to you and stare at it is mm-hmm. not going to make it faster or better.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, basically those progressive, creative work when, you know, you literally create, you know, the creative.
Yes.
But, you know,
pairing works great
maintaining and fixing, that's a completely different operation.
Yes. Now, also, I've been talking about extreme programming, which by its very name is extreme, and mm-hmm. that's just not going to work for everyone, and you're not going to be allowed to do that just anywhere. So in Agile, you can adopt a number of Agile techniques here and there and get a lot of benefit, like what you were just talking about. When you have some creative things to do in terms of designing screens, well, ask one of your coworkers who also knows design, ask them to work with you and work with them when they're doing that kind of work, and you'll get a lot of benefits.
Mm-hmm. With UX, a lot of organizations, for example, Doc Collins, that I, one of the regulars on my podcast, he used to be an army of one, basically one UXer for, you know, the entire development project, so he wouldn't have anywhere to go to, and that's a case for quite a few companies. I think Pavel, the UX designer from Bloomberg, who was on my very last episode, I think he also mentioned that he is the only UX designer in the group that is involved in the product development. Going back to justification of the cost, it reminded me of that episode that we recorded with Doug. He mentioned a study, forgot what the name of it was, but somehow they approximately measured that 50% of developers' time goes to fixing problems. I don't know how accurate that is, maybe you can relate, but if it's more or less accurate, you know, between 25 and 50% or something like that, that would be a really great proof that you invest that incremental expense into pair programming, but you will reduce the number of those broken things that come back, and then they damage the user experience, the brands, and then they create all those huge amounts of rework on the developer side and on pretty much the whole project team side. So I think that's one of the points that can be used to if you are trying to convince higher ups to give you a green light for extreme programming.
Yes. Well, you just described one of the best cost benefit analysis of test-driven development and how it can make sense, because it is true that with conventional development, most developers spend half their time doing debugging, which is kind of a dirty secret. We spend half our time doing debugging and also a lot of manual testing, which is really tedious. Now, with test-driven development, it's true that you have to write twice as much code because you're writing all these tests. But retesting is then incredibly fast and easy, and there is almost no debugging because everything is written incrementally with automated regression tests. Whenever there's a bug, the bugs are usually a lot easier to track down and fix. So that makes us twice as productive right there, which is kind of eaten up by writing the test code, but at least that you break even on that and hope to get benefits other, in other places.
And this actually brings up a good thought. Throughout my experience, and you know, I hear it all the time from other people, organizations, they underestimate the importance of testing. They cut the times, they cut the budgets for testing, they just deploy it and will, you know, test it in the wild. That's probably Apple's approach these days with every new iOS. But, you know, because you write all this test code in pair programming, that gives you this solid infrastructure, testing infrastructure that you utilize down the road, and it becomes your culture, your mindset, and testing actually becomes not, it becomes less and less expensive and less tedious down the road as you build up that testing infrastructure, that testing code, that expertise of writing those multiple quick tests. I think that's something that is consistently overlooked. And I think, I mean, what we just discussed, it just kind of made me connect those dots. And I think that pair programming could be a great answer to that huge, you know, universal problem that organizations have with testing, because they just don't believe in them.
Yes, in terms of cost, there are some pretty good numbers out there in the industry showing that the cost of fixing a bug rises exponentially with the time that is delayed before you find the bug. That is, the later you find the bug, the more expensive it is to fix, exponentially.
Really, oh, absolutely.
Which is very, very, very bad.
Because you start building more stuff on top of the bug, and then, you know, the whole thing can be invalidated.
Oh, yes. But if you do things test-driven development, you find most bugs almost immediately and fix them very quickly. So that dramatically cuts the cost of fixing the bugs.
Gotcha. So we've been rolling really well. We are already at, you know, 45 minute mark. I have another quick question for you.
Sure.
In terms of UX design. After that, feel free to bring up some other stuff that, you know, maybe other challenges that you are running into outside of extreme programming or code ownership type of stuff. But with the extreme programming, because you guys, the dynamics are slightly different, how do you work with UX designers to make sure that, I would assume that UX designers' pace would change as well, or some kind of a process or dynamics of engaging with you guys?
I have not really dealt with that significantly. Quite often we as developers have just done the user interface, and I have to admit that we're not very artistic. Certainly I would be willing to work with good UX designers in whatever way works best for them. Certainly we want to do incremental development, maybe starting from a prototype and then fleshing it out with real functionality. That's something that I've done on some projects. So you just have to be kind of creative and work with what you've got.
Okay, that's a fair answer. Actually, I want to ask another silly question, which can actually, you know, make a fool out of me, but, you know, I'm fine with that. So when somebody writes a piece of code, and that kind of goes back to the code ownership conversation as we started discussing this, and then, you know, some changes need to be made, and then another developer comes over and obviously sounds like the code will not be very easy to understand. Why is that the case? Because, I mean, I'm just curious to know, because, for example, if I know HTML and if I opened some simple HTML website written by somebody else, as long as the guy is not crazy, I would still see, you know, tag table, tag image, tag table width, you know, those kind of like basic elements, right? Why is it hard? Assuming you guys are speaking the same language, right? Like, you know, Java or, I mean, whatever, C++, whatever you're coding. So why is it hard for other developers to kind of open it up and understand the code very easily?
Well, HTML is a quite straightforward language that there are real limits as to what it can do by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you get more involved in JavaScript and the various libraries that are involved with doing like single page screens on the browser, React, there are quite a few JavaScript libraries that have hundreds of thousands or even millions of lines of code. Understanding the code behind these web browser screens can be quite challenging. The more code there is, the harder it can be to understand that.
Gotcha. So basically, somebody coded a piece of software, or, you know, inside the software, because they used certain lines of code from those, you know, thousands of libraries, and the other person just happens not to be familiar with that. That's what drives that.
Well, that, and you often have to write hundreds of thousands of lines or more of code specific to your business and the way that you do things. And you're going to use a lot of concepts and write your own libraries. Well, nobody's going to know those things until after they've worked with your code a lot and read a lot and come to understand it, which can take a fairly long amount of time.
Mm-hmm. This makes perfect sense. And as I said, if I made a fool of myself by asking this silly question, that's fine. But I think I learned actually a lot from this answer.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. Do you have anything else to add? Some, you know, wisdom that you would like to share with the listeners?
Well, I'd just like to say that no one has to dream about extreme programming or wait for it to happen, because many of the tools and techniques are available to almost everyone who does software development. Like in the Java environment, JUnit is standard across the whole industry. Everyone can use it. So even if you're not going to do full-on extreme programming or pair programming, you can write JUnit tests. And so you can have some improvement. So just try it out and see how it works for you.
Awesome. Okay, well, we will wrap that up here. Jeff, thank you for coming to the podcast. And thank you guys for tuning in. I really appreciate your time. And so it's Friday night, and everybody have a great weekend. Thank you.
And thank you.